Blog Talk Radio.
Greetings and welcome to Mount Olympus. I am Hercules Invictus, and tonight I'm proud to bring you a special edition of the Diana Monfort Show. A warning first, we're in the midst of a storm here in New Jersey. The governor closed schools and ended school activities early. Libraries were closed and so on and so forth. So in case the storm hits here, we may lose electricity. If that happens, we will continue with a part two of this particular episode because I'm looking forward to hearing it. Greetings and welcome, Diane. How are you?
Hi, how are you? I'm so looking forward to this.
Me too.
And my wonderful guest, Donald Olson, the author, playwright, prolific author, gardening expert. So anyway, well, okay, just a short, quick thing. The Diana Monfort Show has been on cable television now for 34 years. I'm Diana Monfort, literally the world's first transgender television journalist. I know this because I was in Democratic politics, and they checked very carefully, and then they told me that I was the first transgender television journalist, and that I had to say that all the time because we need our history. Well, here we go. Speaking of history, we are going to discuss the wonderful, groundbreaking pioneer transgender woman, Christine Jorgensen, who was the first famous transgender woman on Earth, long before Lily Elba, long after, but Lily didn't really make quite of a splash, and you know, she died young and all sorts of things. Well, in Christine's day, they already had antibiotics, so surgery wasn't that dangerous. And Christine was of Danish descent. Her parents were from Denmark. She grew up in the Throgsnæk section of the Bronx. She went to Denmark, had a series of operations and hormone treatments, came back a beautiful blonde woman. The headline in the Daily News was, XGI becomes blonde beauty. Operations transform Bronx youth. And she embarked on a theatrical career. She was not a natural performer. She had to be carefully coached by Miles Bell, her stage partner. Miles Bell was born in Pennsylvania. He was one of six children. He was from a coal mining family, but he decided that wasn't for him. And he left it early in life in his late teens and became a show business person and married another show business person. And, they formed an act together. It was very successful. They worked all over the world in nightclubs. And in those days, nightclubs were everywhere. This was in the infancy of television. And nightclubs were not the mad mosh pit free-for-alls they are today. They were sophisticated environments, and grown-ups went. It wasn't just for very young people. You could be any age and go to a nightclub and not feel odd about it. Christine Jorgensen had a life in show business. She often held forth on television and radio on her transgender experience. And she became a university speaker. And ultimately, she died roughly 1 week before her 63rd birthday of bladder and lung cancer, sadly. Speaking of lung cancer, I hope I don't have it. But anyway, Christine Jorgensen was a true groundbreaker, a pioneer. And everyone should be grateful to her because, you know, sexual freedom is sexual freedom. And women should be grateful to her, men. She was one of the opening salvos of the sexual revolution. And so we should all be grateful to her. And as we all know, bodily autonomy is highly contested today in the United States. And Christine Jorgensen was an avatar of self-determination and bodily autonomy. And now my guest, playwright, author, gardening expert, songwriter, Mr. Donald Olson. Hello, Donald.
Hello, Diana. Boy, I don't know if I can add anything after that introduction to Christine, but can you believe that when Christine came back, it was 1953. That was 71 years ago. Boy, talk about a groundbreaker, huh? A trailblazer.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
1953. And every newspaper account mentioned her aplomb, her elegance, her Joan Crawford-like pizzazz. You know,
yes.
I mean, she was not a self-conscious shrinking violet. She swept in, smiling, looking regal and movie starish. She was great.
She was great. You know, some of that, of course, was sheer chutzpah, because Christine, you know, by temperament, certainly, was a fairly shy person. And in part, she was shy because she'd always felt, you know, she was such a different person. She was different from everyone else. She didn't know quite how to identify that, but she felt, out of the mainstream. And that's why she embarked on her really groundbreaking, you know, exploration of what became transgender procedures and surgery. You know, it was not allowed in the United States. She really didn't have anywhere to go in terms of, you know, medical professionals to help her. And so,
well, it was illegal to castrate a man in the United States. The idea of creating a vagina had never occurred to most doctors.
Right, and still hasn't.
Well, no, but sadly, Christine had the old-time procedure, which is where they cut everything off and then graft skin on from your thighs to create a vagina. A later technique, and the technique used today, is to invert the penile skin, and that is your vaginal canal. But sadly, that arrived too late for Christine Jorgens.
But, I mean, you say sadly, but I think Christine was, I think her story is one of triumph and, you know, emotional happiness, really. And I don't think that she ever regretted having, you know, having the surgery as it was available to her then. And don't forget, Christine also really convinced Dr. Christian Hamburger in Copenhagen, a very famous endocrinologist and surgeon, that this is what she wanted to do. She really had to convince him, and she did. She went to Denmark. She was going to go to Sweden because she'd heard sort of through the grapevine somehow that this surgery was being done in Sweden. And so she bought a one-way ticket. She landed in Copenhagen because she had relatives there. And by the way, it was not her parents who came over from Denmark. It was her grandparents. But she still had relatives there. She still had relatives there. She met one of her, I think it was her cousin, and told the cousin what she was planning to do and why she'd come over. And the cousin said, you know, you don't have to go to Sweden because I just read a story in the newspaper about someone, a doctor here, who is dealing with this kind of thing. So she met Dr. Christian Hamburger immediately. I mean, Christine didn't put anything off. I mean, once she got the scent, she was on it. You know what I'm saying?
Well, she'd been
taking estrogen
here in the U.S.
She had been taking estrogen, and she'd been taking that not through any doctor's, you know, advice or she'd basically been experimenting with estrogen on herself. She'd managed to get hold of a prescription for some. And
well, you could say that she, in effect, was one of the architects of the transgender process.
I think she was the architect of the transgender process. I think that that's one of her enormous achievements. She also, you know, the process then, Diana, and you know this probably far better than I do, but the process then, and I think it's changed quite a bit since then, involved having to have psychiatric evaluations.
It was that way when I transitioned in 1975, yes.
Right. And I think it's only fairly recently that trans folk has said, you know what, we don't need a psychiatrist to tell us who we are. But in Christine's case, and at that period of time, and we have to remember all the nomenclature and the procedure, as you mentioned, all of this has changed over the years. But back then, Christine had to have psychiatric, I don't know if it was counseling, but she certainly had to see a psychiatrist. And it was a whole different setup. You know, she had, it took 2.5 years about, and she made it happen. She made it happen, and she was really the first American that we really know of, really, who did make it happen. And the result of all of that, of course, was that she became the most famous transgender celebrity of the period. She garnered more headlines than, you know, Julius Ethel Rosenberg at the time. She was the most famous, certainly not, I don't want to say she was the most famous transgender woman, because there were no other famous transgender women at the time.
That
she
we
was
know
one of.
Of
the most famous, yeah, that we know of. She was the most one of the most famous women in the world, you know, and her every move was scrutinized by the press or the media. Everything she wore, the way she moved,
and excuse
height,
me, she made all of her own clothes, including her stage costumes. She was a multi-talented person.
She was a multi-talented person, and you know, and let's just back up just a little bit before Christine went over to Denmark and had the procedure done, or pioneered the procedure, we should say. She'd looked around for some kind of fulfilling career or job, and she hadn't really found it. She'd gone to Hollywood at some point to see if there was something she could do out there. She had been making news reels, editing newsreels for Archeo Pathé here in New York City. She had gone to school to become a radiation technologist. And none of that really, satisfied her. And she just could not figure out how to change her life to fit into what she knew her life should be. And she started to go to the a library that's actually right across the park from me, right across Central Park from me, not far from you, on 105th and Central Park West. And in that library, she found a book called The Male Hormone, which talked about testosterone and estrogen. And it suddenly was like a light bulb went off, and she figured out that that was part of what she needed to do. She needed to change her hormonal structure. So she was 25 when she went over to Denmark with a one-way ticket, and she was 27 when she came back and, you know, really hit the headlines big time.
Well,
but
and she certainly made a splash. And now the fact that she was beautiful,
yes,
probably eased her path considerably.
I would say that that's true. That's definitely true. She had a glamorous beauty. I maintain, I don't know if this is true because nobody's ever said this or written this, but I think that working on all of those Archeo Pathé newsreels and so on, she probably was very, very aware of the importance of feminine glamour at that period, you know, Hollywood.
Excuse me,
glamour.
When you study photography at that time,
yes, yes,
you also studied makeup. And looking at the photographs of her, the first ones as a woman, I can see, being an actress myself, that she's wearing beautiful, perfect, at that time, theatrical makeup. In other words, movie makeup.
Yeah.
And it's beautifully done, you know? I mean, model quality. And she often was a model. They would print, Newsday in Long Island, where she lived mm-hmm. later on with her parents.
Mm-hmm.
She lived in Massapequa. Was printed a huge picture of her in a huge picture hat for their Easter 1954, I believe, edition. And they made no mention of the fact that that was a trans woman. Just, isn't this a beautiful woman? Isn't that amazing?
That is really amazing. That's really amazing. And let's back up one more time to mention that she had sold her story to the Hearst newspapers. You know, I think it was called American Weekly, and it was like a supplement that people received with their, you know, Sunday papers. And in that, it was a five-part series, and she talked about her life and what she had done. And this was really kind of what got the public initially really interested in her. So she was media aware, certainly, but she also, I don't want to say she was a victim, because I don't think in many ways Christine Jorgensen was a victim in any way. However, the press was often very hostile to her, male press in particular.
Terrible. And evil.
Yeah.
Saying,
yeah.
Oh, she looks like a lanky boy in makeup, or, well, Jane Russell has nothing to worry about. She won't be a bra model. I mean, vicious, nasty stuff, you know.
Yeah, vicious stuff. And this figures into my play, The Christine Jorgensen Show, somewhat, because when the play takes place in 1953, when she's just come back from Denmark, and she's, you know, casting around for what she can do with her life, because, and she says in the play, you know, I'm so famous, I can't have any kind of a normal job. So what happened?
Yeah, no working the night shift at 7-Eleven, yeah.
That was before 7-Eleven.
Well, no working the night shift at Piggly Wiggly or something. Okay.
Piggly Wiggly, right. She had to earn a living, right? And she made quite a lot of, I mean, you know, if we translate the amounts of money that she made in today's currency, the money she made from selling to the Hearst newspapers was astronomical for the time. But
$25,000, which is what she got.
$25,000.
Was an amazing amount in a time where people made $75 a week.
Correct. And she, with that money, you know, she actually had a house built for her parents and herself in Massapequa. She bought, you know, for a coach, she bought a new Cadillac, she bought all kinds of things that she otherwise would not have. She was raised in a very modest, you know, not a poor household.
Her father was a contractor, and he was successful, but sadly,
yes,
her childhood took place during the Great Depression.
Yes.
And
depression
most people weren't building or buying houses in those days, so yeah,
no,
that was a problem.
No, that's correct. That's correct. But I would say part of Christine's success is her emotional success, and I think her emotional success really depended upon the closeness of her family. You know, she did.
I was very lucky that way. I had a totally supportive family.
It's an important part of our mental health, I think. And Christine came from a very close-knit family. Her parents were supportive. I think her father had some real difficulties, and of course, when she wrote to them to explain for the first time from Denmark what she had done, and she was now their daughter and not their son. Of course, they were, you know, shocked and didn't know quite what to make of it, but they wrote back and said, "We love you more than ever." And you know,
she included the famous photograph, the blonde beauty photograph, which is,
right,
I think, one of the first ones taken of her as a woman, because she worked in a photo lab off the books in Denmark just to bring in some cash. And she couched it in terms of, I was born with a hormonal imbalance, and I have corrected nature's mistake. She didn't say, I'm a fag and I got it cut off so I can be a hot chick. She, you know, I mean, she couched it in terms that they could relate to and sympathize with, I think.
Right. Yes, I think that's true. And, oh my gosh, well, as we just said, the media coverage was just phenomenal for that period of time and for America at that time. Oh my God, 1953,
well, you know, in
America.
1975, when I transitioned, I was lucky enough to be a smart cookie, and I went to Dr. Harry Benjamin, another originator of the process.
Correct.
And that's why I'm still alive today, because I've never stinted on good doctors.
Right.
And she did. No, I should say that in Christine's day, they were taking shots in the dark about hormone therapy.
Mm-hmm.
And they used such a strong concentration of estrogen at the beginning because they didn't know any better.
Because they didn't
know. Birth control pills were the same thing when those started in 1960.
Right.
That huge concentration of estrogen that she got very often at the beginning could have contributed to her bladder and lung cancer, although her endless smoking and drinking didn't help.
That's true. That's very true. Yes, the estrogen was very important in her life, and as you say, the amounts, I mean, they measured her urine every day, you know, for months. So they did what they could at the time in terms of scientific research, and hoping that it would be, you know, a successful transition to her. But, you know, these things are changing all the time, and, you know, the amounts of hormones and all of that kind of stuff, it was pretty intense. I think it was probably very intense.
Well,
I mean,
when I started...
In a mood changer, too, in some ways.
Yes, it was. And when I started, I used to get injections and pills. I now only take pills. And eventually, I got breast lumps, which thankfully were nothing. But, and my mood swings, my boyfriend said, you're like five different people. I mean, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it really, and you could descend very easily from smiling good cheer to outrageous, uncontrollable rage.
Right. I had a section in an earlier version of the play where Christine talked about taking hormones and how they could alter her mood and so on and so forth. I've had things removed in the rewrites. But it was an important part of her life. But, you know, as a performer, she couldn't afford to have those moods, at least on stage, right? She had to be up, and she had to be the performer, the entertainer. And that's what she did.
Yes, but
so that, go ahead.
Compared with Marilyn Monroe, she was a model of emotional stability. So, you know.
Well, you
another
know,
hot blonde of the 50s.
That's right. And there is a photo of Christine. You know, when Mitzi Russell did that kind of famous record recording interview of her.
She's prettier than Marilyn,
Christine
frankly.
Speaks, she looked similar, really, to Marilyn Monroe. She had a kind of gamin look about her, kind of vulnerable, sweet.
She's wearing a dark green sweater, and she's a knockout.
Yeah, yeah, she's just beautiful. But
I mean, I'm sorry, Marilyn, but she's prettier than Marilyn in that photo.
Well, we all love Marilyn Monroe, too, you know.
Oh, what was that?
We all love Marilyn Monroe, too.
I love Marilyn, and I am a huge Marilyn fan. But, you know, drug addiction and alcoholism are not beauty cures. Let's put it that way, Marilyn.
No, that's
but
true.
Okay.
She didn't. Yeah, that's true. So let's talk a little bit about the show, because what I want to say is that, you know, when you're writing a play about a historical figure, as I did here, and as I have done often in the past, I wrote my play Oscar and Walt is about the meeting between Oscar Wilde and Walt Whitman, you know, in Camden, New Jersey in 1882.
Which is exceedingly successful. It's produced by regional theaters all the time.
And my play about Aubrey Beardsley has been done in London and Amsterdam and so on.
You like those perverts, don't you, Donnie? Okay.
Really, Diana. So anyway, I'm always interested in big figures, you know, big, unique figures, and trying to tease out the human qualities behind the what we would call the legend or the icon, you know? And so during COVID, you know, I just had a big reading of Oscar and Walt had been performed in Rome, and it had a big reading at the National Arts Club in New York. And then COVID struck, and everything theatrical and everything else came to a crashing halt. And COVID was a horrible, horrible, still is, a horrible experience for most people. For me, as a writer, it gave me a unique and I will always be grateful for this opportunity to just think about what I really wanted to write and work on it, do the research, do the writing. So I had done Oscar and Walt. I was looking around for my next project. I wanted to write a musical, Don't ask me why, although I do love musicals. So that's probably.
But a nice one, not Springtime for Christine.
Oh, no, not Springtime for Christine. And because I met Mark Nadler, who is the co-star of the show, Mark had stepped in, saved my ass. He stepped in as the director for Oscar and Walt at the National Arts Club when the original director suddenly passed away. And so I got to know Mark.
Was it something you said? I'm sorry.
Maybe it was something I wrote. I don't know.
There you go.
Mark,
did you invite him
in
to lunch? Which is super fun. No. Yes.
I got to know Mark a bit, and what I didn't know was that Mark was a nightclub entertainer.
And a phenomenally talented one. I saw him in an earlier version of your musical, Christine.
Right.
Just great. Unbelievably talented.
Yes.
Odd that he's not super famous.
Well, he's famous within the cabaret world, that's for sure.
He's won every award you can win, yes.
He's won every cabaret award, and he's performed for 14,000 people, and he's performed at nightclubs, and he's performed with symphony orchestras. He's performed, everywhere. So anyway, I got to know Mark, and I went to see a couple of his nightclub shows, and I thought, God, it would be wonderful to run a show, featuring someone who could do what Mark does, which is play the piano brilliantly, sing beautifully, tap dance marvelously, and act. He can do everything. I mean, just a phenomenal person, entertainer. So I sort of had it in the back of my mind, if I wrote a musical, maybe Mark could somehow play a part in all of that. And I was wondering about Christine again. I'd been aware of her for decades, right? I've been aware of her since I was really young. I've been aware
of her. Well, excuse me, you look like Christine.
Oh,
you're
please.
Of Swedish descent, I believe. And you have a long, narrow face.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you could be her brother.
Well, I could be her
or
brother.
Christine, if she had stayed George. You're much better looking than George. But George had his ears pinned back, by the way. Take it to an actor.
Yes, that was the one that Christine said she did have plastic surgery.
And she had. She won the Irish sweepstakes. She and her mother bought a ticket together, and with her half of the winnings, she got a complete upper plate, in other words, false teeth. And later, when she was Christine, this was when she was George, Elsa Maxwell and others wrote, oh, and she has lovely teeth. Well,
which she did. But now I want to get back to my story, Diana.
I'm sorry, but this is so rich in detail.
Oh, we could talk forever. We could talk forever about Christine and my show, of course. And me, we could talk forever. I just want to get back to writing this show. So anyway, I've been aware of Christine for decades, and especially since her autobiography came out in 1967. And if you were young and gay back then, and you read this,
as I was.
Yes, and we just didn't. I didn't know what to make of it.
I certainly did.
Well, you did, but I thought, is this what I have to do with my life now? Is that my identity? Well, I knew it. Ultimately, of course, I knew it wasn't. But, it was just so new, right? And that book was a bestseller. It sold 400,000 copies, which is huge for a
country. Can I just tell you a short, quick story?
Sure.
Christine appeared on talk shows at that time. I was 11, and I lived in Greenwich Village. So I was all too familiar with the trans experience. You saw them everywhere.
Right.
And my mother came into my bedroom and said, you have to see this. Christine Jorgensen is going to be on something called the Woody Woodbury Show. And a syndicated talk show. And I said, I'm reading. And she said, no, please. So she took me into her all pink bedroom. Maybe she was a tranny, who knows. But anyway, and we watched Christine Jorgensen on the Woody Woodbury show, and I wasn't, frankly, tremendously impressed. She was an older lady by then. She and my mother had both been born in 1926. I frankly thought she wore too much jewelry, but she was lovely to look at.
Yeah.
And, I certainly, she put a bee in my bonnet, let's put it that way.
She put a bee
about transitioning.
Bonnets. Yeah, she put a bee in many bonnets. Christine received thousands upon thousands of letters.
Excuse me.
From fans and from trans people Diana, are you back? Are you back?
I smoke like crazy, too.
I know. Anyway, she received thousands and thousands of letters from trans people saying, thank you, you know, you've given me hope. You know, you kind of defined what I feel myself. And she responded to just thousands of these letters and tried to hook people up with the correct doctors or with the information that was available at the time and so on. I mean, she really was really generous in that sense. It wasn't just, she was a show business person, a celebrity, and all that entails, but she really did go out of her way to help people as well. So I think that was a really important part of her legacy, you know.
I think she'd grown up a very religious person, and she had the spirit of charity in her, you know.
Yeah, she'd grown up as a Presbyterian family, and she'd had a couple, as when she was younger, she'd had a couple of, well, let's just call them deeply, however we want to define that, deeply spiritual or religious experiences, you know. And I think later on she moved away from that when she realized some of the things that organized religions sought to do to trans, gay, and everyone else who didn't fit in. But yes, I think that was part of her upbringing. She was raised to be a modest person, and that's also in my show, and part of what makes it, I think, somewhat fun, in that, as she said, I'm too famous to have any kind of an ordinary job. And so Miles Bell, this former vaudevillian, song and dance man, you know, one of that forgotten legion of entertainers who sang and pattered and joked and danced in nightclubs, you know, before
my mother did the same thing. Yes, I know.
I know. And Miles helped her craft an act, right? Now, in my show, he also writes all the songs for her. This was not what really happened. But, well, we could talk forever about all of this. I mean, when you're doing the research for this kind of a show or this kind of personality, you have to look at every source that's available to you, and there's not very, very little, practically nothing about Miles Bell. We know he was, you know, considered a fairly debonair kind of, you know, entertainer. Worked in nightclubs. Had been on stage and working in entertainment since he was a teenager. But anyway, in my show, it's Miles who helps Christine craft her act, as he did in real life. But
I was going to say he actually did.
Yes, he did. But he did not write the songs. I wrote all the songs because we have no document. We have scanty documentary evidence as to what was in the show. We know a couple of the songs that she sang, one of which was Rodgers and Hammerstein's I Enjoy Being a Girl.
And Getting to Know You, she sang that one as well, yes.
And she also sang Making the Whoopee. And
she sang what?
Making Whoopee. Do you know that song?
The Eddie Cantor song, yes.
Yeah, Making Whoopee. That was one of her songs. But at any rate, we couldn't use the Rodgers and Hammerstein's song. I mean, the royalty, it just would have been prohibitive to use any of those songs. And the Rodgers and Hammerstein estate probably would not have allowed us to do that. So I thought, okay, well, I'll just write the songs myself. And did. And with Mark's help, we put them all together. And they're scattered throughout the show. It's not a musical in the sense that, you know, the characters stop suddenly and burst into song, a song that, you know, describes their emotions or their feelings or their, you know, love interest or their, you know, where they are. The songs in my show, the Christine Jorgensen show, are all there in a realistic manner. They're organic, as you know, they're organic because at first they're part of the rehearsal process that they're going through, and then they are in. And then the last part of the show is imagined recreation of their actual act. And so in that sense, they are singing the song as they would at some of them in the nightclub, which was the Copa Club in Pittsburgh, where they opened their act in 1953. So,
now, she'd done a travelogue in Denmark, which fell flat. She opened it in Los Angeles. and the reviews were abysmal to hideous. And
yes.
That's when she decided to hook up with Charlie Yates, her agent, who hooked her up with Miles Bell. Now, let's talk about, now, the co-director of this show is a trans woman.
Correct. Zoe Adams. Oh, she's just brilliant. She's wonderful. It's wonderful to work with Zoe, and it's wonderful, certainly, to have her perspective. She's co-directing with Michael Barakiva, and she's a wonderful dramaturge as well. So she has a great sense of dramatic scenes, she's also an actor. So she brings so much to the table, you know, and it's just been great working with her. I mean, we start rehearsals next Tuesday, so that's going to be really exciting, too. I'm just so happy that Zoe came on board.
I am, too. I had a long conversation with her over the telephone. She's an absolute delight.
Yeah, she's a delight. And
now, about the star. James, Jesse James Keitel.
Correct. Jesse James Keitel. Jesse James Keitel, we're just going to call him Jesse, is a trans actor. We have to say actor now instead of actress, right? Is that right?
That's I don't.
Typical. I know you don't. But you're so many things that you don't do, Diana.
I know. And then again, there are so many things that I do. Lie back. No. Kidding.
I know. So, Jesse is a young trans actor, actress, who has made a name, or is making a name for herself in film and television. She was in an episode of Star Trek. She was in a crime series on, I think, ABC called Big Sky. She was the first non-binary actor to actually play a major regular leading role in a, you know, major network series, Big Sky. She was in a movie called Miller and Son, which won an award or two. She's done a lot of film work and TV work. So,
and yes, she is
out,
a distant relative of the great Harvey Keitel.
Okay.
Well,
yes,
she
that's
is.
Important. Okay. I don't think it is. Yeah, but anyway, she probably is a distant relative.
Well, talent runs in the family.
Yeah, sometimes it does. It doesn't always. I can't say that's true of my family. But she is coming back to New York from L.A., and she's incredibly excited to originate this world premiere role. And when I say this is a world premiere, you know, we had a first stage greeting at the National Arts Club a couple of years ago. Then we had a kind of stage presentation, which you saw, at the Wild Project.
Which was excellent, by the way,
yeah,
with Mark Nadler and the lovely and talented Nicola Gorham,
right,
who was unavailable for this production. And so, and Jesse really went after it. She auditioned several times, came to callbacks. This woman really wanted to play Christine, so she gave it her all.
Well, she was introduced to us by our casting director, Charlie Hanno, and who, you know, brought her to our attention. And we first met her via Zoom interview because she was out in L.A. and we were all in New York. And then we did a slight audition. We did an audition. We had, you know, I have to say, Diana, the amount of trans talent is mind-boggling to me.
I'm well aware of that. And dare I blow my own horn and say that I played Christine in one of your plays during the last 2 years of her life, the Christine Jorgensen Collection.
Yes, blow your horn, because everyone thought you were absolutely great. So, yes.
Thank you so much.
Yes,
well, keep me in mind
listener.
For future parts, kid.
Yes, dear listener, you must know Diana played Christine Jorgensen in my other play called Transition, the Christine Jorgensen Collection, which takes place towards the end of Christine's long and storied and legendary career. And everyone who saw it said, oh, my God, she's good.
Oh, thank you so much.
But I should say...
And I was dying of a cold when we shot it, but thank you so much.
You were indeed. And People can actually watch you, you know, in that show. If they want to, they can Google Transition, the Christine Jorgensen Collection, Donald Stephen Olson. And I'm pretty sure that it will come up. In fact, I'm almost positive it will come up as a YouTube video, and they can watch it. Now, I have to tell people, this is not a stage production. This is not filmed, a film stage production. It was during COVID. It was done as a online, you know, video kind of production. So it's not, you're not seeing people on a stage acting and interacting with one another. You're seeing them doing an enhanced reading, I would say, but acting with props and everything else. So, and it's fantastic. It's really interesting. It's very moving. And there are two other trans actresses in the play. And so what I started to say was the amount of trans talent in New York has just been mind-boggling to me, because I've been working with, you know, Christine-related plays now for 3 years, and I've seen a lot of people auditioning and else and another four. And by the way, we have a whole lot of trans people in our crew who are at the Christine Jorgensen Show, which is also fabulous. We really wanted to stack it that way as much as we possibly could. So, people, if you want to watch Diana Montfort, who for 34 years, I can't believe you said 34 years, has been hostess of the Diana Montfort Show, you can just Google Transition to Christine Jorgensen Collection by Donald Stephen Olson, and you will be able to watch her in action as Christine. Yes, it was really, that was a fun experience, I hope you said. It was a very fun experience. No, I don't know. What were we talking about, Diana? We've been talking about
your wonderful show, which opens on Valentine's Day.
It does open on Valentine's Day. It has previews that begin on February 8th. So the run is basically considered. Gee, I think I should stop. Let you. Tell me when you're back.
I'm back.
Are you back? You're back? Okay.
Did you hear me cough?
Yes, dear, I heard you cough.
Oh, dear, that is a shame.
I did hear you cough. No, we officially open on Valentine's Day, but we start preview performances on February 8th. The official opening is on Valentine's Day, February 14th. We run all the way to March 3rd. We have shows at 7:30 p.m. on every evening except Sunday. We have a matinee at 2:30. Monday, we're dark, meaning there's no show. And we have another matinee on Wednesdays at 2:30. And other than that, we have all of our shows at 7:30 p.m. And it's at 59 East 59 Street Theaters, which is a wonderful theater complex.
Where exactly is that?
Well, it's
what avenue?
It's on East 59th Street, right next to Madison Avenue. Really easy to get to. And really state-of-the-art theaters. There are three theaters in this complex. We're in the Cabaret Theater, the smaller one. And
the tickets are excessively priced.
Yes, they're $35, which is unheard of in New York City for an off-Broadway show. There's $35. And we're able to do this because 59 East 59 is a not-for-profit theater, and we're trying to encourage theater going, and make the shows as accessible as possible to as many people as want to see them. So
now, you want to take this to Broadway?
Well, yes, I would love to take the show to Broadway, obviously. You know, this is theater. You don't know what's going to happen the next day. I just want to see this show up and running at 59 East 59 because it's going to be so fabulously fun and thrilling for me, really, with this fantastic cast of two, you know, Jesse and Mark working together. The third character is a piano. You know, it's a three-hander. And it's going to be a very intimate experience for the audience. They're going to be almost like they're in a nightclub, I mean, in a way. And it's just going to be wonderfully fun and beautifully directed, lovely costumes, you know, everything. Everything that makes theater fun and thrilling to go to. Because live theater, for me, Diana, I don't know about you, but for me, it's where it's at. I just love it. I always have. I grew up going to the Guthrie Theater in Minneapolis, the first regional theater in the United States, and I've never lost my love of live theater. It just gives something to the spirit that nothing else can do. And
as an actor, I can say that I've done television, films, and theater. Theater really feeds you because you really are interacting with the audience.
Yes, you're interacting with the audience and with your fellow actors in the same way. I want to mention, by the way, if you want tickets, it's very easy. The website is just 59e59.org. That's a small e. 59e59.org. It will bring you up to, you just go to that website, upcoming shows, all the information you can possibly want, including bios, photos of Mark and Jesse, some great artwork, stories about, you know, the cast, the crew. I think there's probably something about me, if you can believe that. And, you'll have all the information you can possibly want. You can buy your tickets right on that website. It's really easy to do. There's nothing difficult.
Can you buy them at the door?
You know, I'm sure you can, but frankly, Diana, we're hoping to sell out.
Okay.
I think if people want, people should maybe think about planning a little bit in advance for this show and booking their seats as soon as they have a date in mind, because they might show up to buy tickets at the door and find out that there aren't any to be had.
Well, so, I'll tell you what, tomorrow when you are on my television show, which will show several times before the opening on February 14th, I always carry my debit card. I don't do computers. I'm truly retro. You can order me a ticket.
Maybe I can do that. We'll see. Yes. No.
Don't do me any favors, Bob. Okay.
No, you're gonna see the show. And I think you're going to love it.
Well, I saw the previous incarnation of it, and it was wonderful. And it was a bare-bones production, but it was great.
Yeah.
It was Mark is so talented, and the role of Christine is so multifaceted and complex.
Yes.
That,
and here, of course,
she
has to sing and dance, too. Right?
Yes, indeed. And be in the looks range of the beautiful Christine.
Yeah.
So to be crude about it, all you chasers out there want to see a hot tranny, go see this show.
Yes, that's true.
I'm refreshingly crude and vulgar, as you can see.
I'm glad you said that, because I never would.
You might think it, though, but okay.
Anyway, no. So what else can we talk about, Diana? Do we have any more time? Oh, we have a few more minutes to talk.
Yes. Well, what's your next project?
Oh, well, I can't talk about that because I'm afraid someone will steal it. It's so brilliant, the idea.
Okay. Well, maybe someday you'll help me write my autobiography.
Yes. Well, speaking of writing, you know, I'm also a novelist. I've written six novels and one collection of gay ghost stories and otherworldly tales called The Great Digger's Daughter.
May I interrupt? Do you think...
Yes.
That Christine's spirit is informing your work, and she might want you to make her better known to today's young people?
I think that's an attractive idea. I don't personally feel that way. However, I have to tell you something weird. Christine and I share the same birthday, May 30th.
Fellow Gemini, yes, I'm May 28th.
Yeah, I didn't know this until I started to do all my research. In fact, we started to write the play, but her birthday is on, well, we used to call it Memorial Day. It's not Memorial Day anymore because they've changed the weekends of Memorial Day. But
and you really do look like her, you know?
Oh, yes. No. Thank you. I think. No, I mean, she's...
Well, you're a very handsome man, so, you know.
And you know what? I dreamed about Christine last night. So that indicates... But, Diana, I don't go for the I don't know. I don't go for the idea that she's somehow, you know, guiding my actions or something like that. It's my actions that I think are important to help introduce the character of Christine. And
yes, but she would have chosen someone who would have the ability and the interest in her. She would have known to choose you.
Well, that may be true, but, you know, Christine didn't believe in an afterlife either, so she gave up on all of that herself. So I just hope that she's happy wherever she may be or not be, that she's, you know, she has. Her life was an active, positive experience. This is what I would say about Christine Jordan's life. She developed herself in the way that she wanted to develop herself. She actualized her personality, herself, her gender, in the way that she wanted, not with no help from anyone else, really, except when she finally met Dr. Hamburger. But she pioneered so much. And as she said, and you mentioned this in your introduction, you know, she didn't start the sexual revolution, but as she said, she gave it a swift kick in the pants. And I think we can look back on that and really kind of be in awe, you know, a little bit about what Christine was able to do at that period of time. I keep going back to the fact that it was, well, yeah, because I keep going back to the fact that it was 1953, 71 years ago, folks.
Deep in the McCarthy era, I might add.
McCarthy era, so there was the Red Scare, there was Korea, there was the atom bomb scare. It was all about fear, you know, war, you know, what's going to happen next. Just
sounds
like today,
familiar
actually.
Somehow.
Yeah, doesn't that sound familiar? I know. So she was going through that in her own way and had to go through issues and experiences that trans people still have to go through. When she was performing in Washington, D.C., she wasn't allowed by the chief of the Washington, D.C. police to use the woman's restroom. And she just said, well, okay, I won't urinate for the entire period that I'm in Washington, D.C. So she had to deal with things like that, too. You know, people pulling her hair to see if it was real and just, you know, things like that. But the other side of it is, Diana, that she also charmed people. She wasn't a threatening person, and she didn't want to portray herself in any way as a threatening personality. Her goal was to really inform, educate, and do this through entertainment of her with her act.
And her show was family-friendly. You could take your children to it.
Exactly. Her show was meant to be very family-friendly. And as you also mentioned, nightclubs back then were everywhere. This was before television, you know, sort of took over everyone's brain. And people still went out for an evening at a nightclub, you know, and they had a couple of drinks and they might have dinner and they had a floor show. And Christine, you know, in some cases was part of a larger, you know, several acts. She was one of several acts. She was billed as the world's most fascinating person ever. In other cases, you know, she was the show. Her act was the show. Now, Miles stayed with the show for about a year and a half, I think, before he left. And, again, there's just so little documentary evidence about Miles Bell. I know we know he went to Chicago. We know he became a stockbroker.
Yes, but excuse me, Christine was so charismatic and lovely. She didn't really need anyone else on stage with her.
Well, she developed the act later on so that she did not have, after Miles left, there was another male entertainer who shared the stage with her. And then after that, she developed.
We are almost out of time.
Okay.
So if you would tell us again where it opens and how people can access tickets.
I will do that. It opens on February 14th, but really February 8th if you want to see previews. Tickets are $35. The theater is 59 East 59th Street Theaters. That's 59th Street in New York City, right next to Madison Avenue. For tickets, go to 59e59.org. 59, the numbers 59, small e, 59.org. You'll get everything you need to know. And I hope you'll see you there. I might be there for every performance. I don't know.
I'm certainly going to get a ticket tomorrow if you'll be kind enough to do the computer thing for me on your phone.
Yes, I might.
And I hope to run into some listeners there when I'm there. And I may go more than once because I'm fascinated by your work and by Christine, so that works.
Well, thank you.
How
so
can
much
people access that. You on your website?
They just go to DonaldStephenOlson.com.
Okay, and they can see your novels, your gardening book. You're a great gardening expert.
Yes, I am. I've written two quite well-known garden tour books about gardens and the public gardens on the West Coast, if people are interested in that. I have my novels and my gay short stories are available as e-books, and those can be ordered right from my website if you want to do that. So all the information is there through the website.
DonaldStephenOlson.com.
Correct.
I strongly urge everyone to see this wonderful musical about Christine Jorgensen. I saw an earlier version. It was terrific, and I cannot recommend it enough, really. I hope we run into one another at the theater because I'm going to go several times. I'm fascinated by Christine and Donald's work. Anyway, I'm Diana Montford. This has been the podcast edition of The Diana Montford Show. Even if no one else loves you, I love you because I have no taste, as you know. No. I love you because you're great and know your own greatness. Know that you have a right to be on this earth just as everyone else has. And I love you a lot, and I will talk to you next time. Bye, everyone.
Bye.
Thank you, Diana. Thank you, Donald, for an excellent show. I wish you great success with your production and all your creative endeavors.
Thank you. Come in and see the show, Hercules.
I'm having spinal difficulty.
Sorry.
My movement is restricted, but when I'm feeling better, I have that on my mind.
Great. I hope you feel better soon.
Thank you. And thanks to a wonderful audience for tuning in. Whether you clicked on a link and found yourself here, whether you dialed and you patiently waited in our queue, or whether you're going to check us out later on demand. Until next time, this is us wishing you joyous journeys, amazing adventures, and a healthy and happy new year. Good night, everyone.